Of course, there was never the slightest chance of my becoming a meteorologist, and I suppose that's how I landed in the stores. It was one of the bizarre periods of my life, mercifully brief, but vivid. They had told me to report to Corporal Weeks at the store's hut, and I made my way through the maze of roads of a Heaton Park populated by strangers. Corporal Weeks was fat, and he gave me a quick look over with crafty eyes. Elliot, eh? Well, you can make yourself useful around here. Not much to do, really. This ain't the main stores. We deal mainly with laundry and boot repairs. As he spoke, a fair-haired young man came in. AC2 Morgan, Corporal, he said. Come for me boots. They've been resold. Wiggs jerked his head, and I had my first sight of the boot mountain. They're in there. They'll be labelled. The young man looked surprised, but he came round behind the counter and began to delve among the hundreds of identical black objects. It took him nearly an hour to find his own pair, during which the corporal puffed at cigarettes with a total lack of interest. When the boots were finally unearthed, he wordlessly ticked off the name on a long list. "This is the sort of thing you'll be doing," he said to me. "Nothing to it." He wasn't exaggerating. There was nothing to life in those stores. It took me only a day or two to realize the sweet existence Weeks had carved out for himself. Store bashing is an honorable trade, but not the way he did it. The innumerable compartments, niches and alcoves around the big hut were all marked with letters or numbers, and there is no doubt the incoming boots and shirts should have been tucked away in order for easy recovery. But that would have involved work, and the corporal was clearly averse to that. When the boots came in, they were tipped out in the middle of the floor, and the string-tied packages of laundry were stacked, shirts uppermost, where they formed a blue tumulus reaching almost to the roof. After 3 days, I could stand it no longer. "Look," I said, "it would pass the time if I had something to do. Do you mind if I start putting all this stuff on the shelves? It would be a lot easier to hand out." Weeks continued to study his magazine. He was a big reader, and at first I thought he hadn't heard me. Then he tongued his cigarette to the corner of his mouth and glanced at me through the smoke. "Now just get this through your head, mate," he drawled. "If I wants any thing doing, I'll, well, tell you. I'm the boss in here and I give the orders, all right?" He resumed his perusal of the magazine. I subsided in my chair. Clearly I had offended my overseer and I would have to leave things as they were. But overseer is a misnomer for Weeks, because on the following day, after a final brainwashing that the procedure must remain unchanged, he disappeared, and except for a few minutes each morning, he left me on my own. I had nothing to do but sit there behind the wooden counter, ticking off the comings and goings of the boots and shirts, and I had the feeling that I was only one of many displaced persons who had fallen under his thrall. I found it acutely embarrassing to watch the lads scrabbling for their belongings, and the strongest impression left with me was of the infinite tolerance of the British race. Since I was in charge, they thought I was responsible for the whole system. But despite the fact that I was of lowly rank, nobody attacked me physically. Most of them muttered and grumbled as they searched, and one large chap came over to the counter and said, "You should be filing away these boots in their proper order instead of sitting there on your arse, you lazy sod." But he didn't punch me on the nose, and I marvelled at it. But still, the knowledge that great numbers of decent young men shared his opinion was uncomfortable, and I found I was developing a permanently ingratiating smile. The only time I came very near to being lynched was when a mob suddenly appeared one afternoon. An unexpected leave pass had been granted, and there were hundreds of men milling around on the tarmac and grass outside the stores. They wanted their laundry, and quick, because they had trains to catch. For a moment, panic seized me. I couldn't let them all inside to fight for their shirts. Then inspiration came. I grabbed an armful of the flat packets from the table and shouted the name on the label. "Walters!" And from somewhere among the surging heads, an eager voice replied, "Here!" I located the source, held the packet between thumb and finger, and with a backhanded flick sent it skimming over the crowd. "Riley!"
"Here!"
"MacDonald!"
"Here!"
"Gibson!"
"Here!"
I was getting quite skillful at it, propelling the blue oblongs unerringly towards their owners, but it was a slow method of distribution. Also, there were occasional disasters when the strings broke in mid-air, sending a shower of collars on the upturned faces. Sometimes the shirts themselves burst free from their wrappings and plunged to earth. It wasn't long before the voices had turned from eager to angry. As my projectiles planed and glided, volleys of abuse came back at me.
"You've made me miss my train, you useless bugger! Bloody Skyver, you want locking up!"
Much of it was in stronger language, which I would rather not record here. But I have a particularly vivid memory of one young man scraping up his laundry from the dusty ground and approaching me with rapid strides. He pushed his face to within inches of mine. Despite the rage which disfigured it, I could see it was a gentle, good-natured face. He looked a well-bred lad, the type who didn't even swear, but as he stared into my eyes, his lips trembled and his cheeks twitched.
"This is a..." he stammered. "This is a bastard system."
He spat the words out and strode away. I agreed entirely with him, of course, but continued to hurl the packets doggedly while somewhere in the back of my mind a little voice kept inquiring how James Herriot, member of the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons and trainee pilot, had ever got into this. After half an hour there was no appreciable diminution in the size of the multitude, and I began to be aware of an increasing restlessness among the medley of waiting faces. Suddenly there was a concerted movement, and the packed mass of men surged at me in a great wave. I shrank back, clutching an armful of shirts, quite certain that this was when they rushed me and beat me up, but my fears were groundless. All they wanted was a speedier delivery, and about a dozen of them swept past me behind the counter and began to follow my example. Whereas there had been only a single missile winging over their heads, the sky was now dark with the flying objects. Mid-air collisions were frequent, collars sprayed, handkerchiefs fluttered, underpants parachuted gracefully, but after an unbearably long period of chaos, the last airman had picked up his scattered laundry, given me a disgusted glance, and departed. I was left in the hut with the sad knowledge that my prestige was very low, and the equally sad conviction that the RAF still did not know what to do with me.